Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
You're listening to Comedy Central.
The Daily Show is taking a break this week, but don't worry, we handpicked some of our favorite episode highlights from the archives just for you. We'll be back with brand new episodes next week. In the meantime, enjoy today's episode.
Welcome back to The Daily Show. My guest tonight, CNN's chief international anchor and host of the Amanpour Hour. Please welcome to the program, Christiane Amanpour. Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to have you on and talk to you. The world is ending.
Well,
it seems that way.
Yes, that's why the eclipse was so beautiful today, because it looked like it was ending, and yet it brought so many people together in this incredibly divided country. Honestly, it was very emotional. It was very emotional.
So, just the answer to this is we just got to do this every day.
I think
now,
so.
The eclipse?
Yeah, I think.
Can't we just pretend?
Focus people's minds.
Put something over it and just block it on there? What is happening? What is the frustration? You're working over at what is the name of it? CNN.
CNN, the big red letters.
I've heard, you know, really.
Most trusted name in news?
What? that's a new branding.
I heard you.
Let me ask you. This. We see it on air, and everybody's working so hard. What do the journalists behind the scenes talk about as their frustrations? What would they like to see covered? How would they like to see it covered? Or are they executing it in the manner in which they think they're satisfied?
Well, here's the thing. You know, you've been talking a lot about Israel, obviously about Ukraine. Our major problem covering Israel-Gaza right now, this phase of it, which has been going on for 6 months, is that we can't get there. This is an unprecedented situation. Journalists are not on the ground in Gaza. And it is.
Well, they're journalists on the ground. They're being killed. They're...
You're right.
Yes.
You're right. I'm talking about independent Western journalists are not able to get there, or anybody else, except for those people who are absolutely risking their lives every single
every
day.
Every day.
Media workers, journalists. Almost 100 have been killed, according to the CPJ, in Gaza, West Bank and Lebanon in 6 months. It is an unprecedented situation. And it goes beyond the horror of what's happened to those people and their families. It's about telling the story of Gaza, telling the story of the Palestinians. You know, actual local journalists would tell you about a people, right? A people, not just, you know, dehumanizing numbers or the like, but a people. And when we go to do our job, and I've been doing this pretty much since the first Gulf War, we go there to be the eyes and ears of everybody who can't go, from who's not a local. But we're not able to get there.
Is this an American problem? Because
no, it's an Israeli problem. They won't
let us in. I don't mean that. I mean that we in this country might not be getting the information, but on social media, on various things, or with Al Jazeera, the world is certainly seeing a very different picture than what Western journalism is showing.
That is very true. And you know, if this terrible law goes through to throw out any organization from Gaza, including Al Jazeera, it would be a terrible thing. Yet another chilling effect on trying to tell the truth in this raging war. So this is a real, real problem. And it is true, many people do get you know, daily news from social media, from actually, as I say, right. the very brave camera people who are there with their phones and with their cameras and
it's
who are feeding things. It is remarkable.
You were covering these types of events from 1983. We all remember that was the occupation in southern Lebanon. It was right.
The Israelis invaded Beirut. They were after the PLO.
Right.
They
and then there was a Lebanese civil war. Out. There was and the rise of Hezbollah in that occupation. There was the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Yeah. We're watching these stories play out redundantly.
Yeah. You know, there's two things, obviously. One is that, you know, history is not always a great teacher. But the other is that, you know, leadership matters. And we are in a crisis of leadership around the world, I genuinely believe. And even as bad as it was in the 1979, in the 80s and all that, there was a period, let's say, in this part of the world, in the Middle East, in the 90s, where there was an actual peace process. Now, we can poo-poo it, we can laugh at it, we can say that it failed, but it failed because the people responsible for enacting it didn't do it and actually sabotaged it. So there have been instances where peace can be forged, where both sides can come together.
Right.
And it depends on the leaders, you know.
But this will take more than both sides. This isn't even both sides. This will have to be a regional peace.
Yeah.
This is a grinding war with no real... I mean, the idea is, well, we're going to do this until we eliminate Hamas. Well, so you're going to just kill everybody? Like, well, what does that even
well,
mean?
I mean, no,
what
is two the things. Plan? There are two things, right? Israel was attacked on October 7th, the worst single-day massacre in its history.
Of course.
And it has the right to defend itself, but, right, the issue is you stay within the guidelines of international law. So now you heard, you know, America's getting very frustrated and concerned.
Well, we're very concerned.
Very concerned.
If, Christiane, if true.
You know.
We are concerned.
You know, it reminded me of something that happened at the State Department during the Rwanda genocide, when a journalist asked the State Department spokesperson in 1994, 30 years ago this week, the woman said there have been acts of genocide committed in Rwanda.
Right.
And the reporter said, well, how many acts of genocide does it take for you to call it a genocide? And she said, I'm not able to respond to that position you're taking. So, you know, we
I'm
have
not
an issue.
A genocidologist.
We have an issue with calling what's happening, certainly back then.
But we have no issue roundly condemning or being very clear with our moral issues. And the other side of it, this isn't about the ability to defend yourself. It's not even about the moral issue. It's about efficacy. It's about, you know, after 9/11, the vindictiveness in me, the bloodlet, like, it certainly rose up. But very clearly, our response was flawed in its efficacy. We made a mistake.
And you know that President Biden said that to Prime Minister Netanyahu when he went there. So did Lloyd Austin. So did many Americans.
Right, but President Biden, when he was in a position to say that to America after 9/11, didn't say that. That's not the position that he took then. But, then the position right. was, yeah, let's go into Iraq, let's go into Afghanistan. You know, it's easy in that retrospect, which is why it feels as though the world order has failed in this moment. And I'm surprised at, and maybe this isn't really the case and I'm misrepresenting this, but the passive nature of the Arab states.
Well, look, that is a big issue because they have now all rushed to make peace and certain accords with Israel, the UAE, Morocco, Saudi Arabia was apparently on the verge of doing it, still is working on it. And I actually have spoken to a lot of Arab leaders. I've said to them, look, for all these years since 1948, when the Palestinians left, the Nakba, when they were forced out, when they were chased out, when they voluntarily left, all that, what happened, and that's what Gaza is, right? The refugees from 1948. When are you going to stand up also and take ownership of this problem? Because the Arab states have had Palestinian refugees for, you know, pretty much 75 odd years.
Well,
and have never given
Jordan,
them.
Jordan, I mean, has probably
has
a larger
never given
Palestinian.
Them citizenship. Ever.
Jordan has not.
No, none of them have.
Right.
Because.
Look, they're all terrified of Hamas and Hezbollah.
That's right.
The dirty little secret over there is the Islamists that they helped foster through madrasas and all those other actions, they're scared shitless of. They just are.
Yeah, and they would like to see Hamas get a bloody nose. There's no doubt about it. But people, the leaders think one thing.
But they don't want accountability for it.
People think another thing. And the people are essentially very upset. The people in that part of the world. And
sure.
The young people
as anybody
all over this
would be
country,
watching
all
these
over the world,
videos.
Are very, very upset.
So why? Tell me why this is naive or wrong that the Arab states form a DMZ to immediately de-escalate this problem. How do they not step in and form some type of guarantee the security of Israel in that moment, guarantee the security of the Palestinians, and stop this carnage?
So there have been certain plans floated. At the moment, the Israeli government wants none of it. It doesn't want the UN. It doesn't want the Arab countries. The only thing that the prime minister
has talked
about...
Does it not see its isolation in the world?
That is what its allies are trying to tell it, that you had the moral high ground and you are very close, if not having lost it. And this is a problem for Israel, because the truth is, as all these people on my show tell me, all the, you know, the experts and the analysts and the leaders, that if this is actually isn't solved politically, then unfortunately it will keep happening, this vicious cycle.
In the future of this, as you look at, when you talked about leadership, then who is the leader that emerges? It's clearly not Netanyahu.
Well, I think the Israeli situation is really interesting, because you have two contrasting facts. The overwhelming majority of the country supports the war.
Sure.
They also want their first priority be their families to come back. They need a ceasefire and a deal to bring their families back. But the overwhelming majority of the Israelis do not support Benjamin Netanyahu. So what the Americans are saying now, and you saw Senator Schumer and others, that there has to be another election at some point. God forbid we would be, you know, meddling in another country, but nonetheless, there has to be election
See,
at some point.
By the way,
point.
That's against the rules-based world order.
This thing, yeah. And then potentially, hopefully, open up another real possibility of a negotiated solution that's backed by the Arab states, as you mentioned, by the United States, by Europe, by all the vested
But why is this not the top priority of... Why is this not the only session that's going on at the UN? Why is everybody not stopping whatever the hell they're doing and hammering this out?
Because, as you know, at the Security Council, there's a lot of people with vetoes and things like that. It hasn't got to that point yet. And the big, big issue right now is famine stalking Gaza and the death toll that's mounting and mounting and mounting. And, you know, even Jose Andres, the chef who you know so well, after the killing of seven of his, workers,
right.
He said, I spoke to President Biden and I said, how can you also send weapons and also call for respecting life
that's
and
right.
The end of this famine. So there's so much that's just...
And how can we only respond to this tragedy when it's seven Western aid workers that are killed? When, you know, when I heard the figure of children, over 10,000, unprecedented. I've never heard
Have
anything
you
like that.
Have you seen the pictures?
Of course. They're haunting. And listen, for Jews, this is heartbreaking because, you know... I don't necessarily have that much of a connection there, but there's this idea that, like, they're sticking it out for all of us because we're not safe anywhere in the world, which, by the way, if that's the issue, that's kind of a larger problem to begin with.
I think for Israelis, for Jews, for Palestinians,
right.
Crucial is that there has to be real leaders who come once and for all and create a peace. And the most important thing also is to be able to converse and discuss. There is nuance and diversity within communities that is not allowed.
Absolutely. But why is that not allowed
because
on American...
Because everybody's
busy
canceling
all the time. Do you know how much shit I want to take for today's show? Do you have any idea what's going to happen? But you're always in the thick of it. Like,
But I have all these diverse opinions on my program. That's
right.
What I try to do. I try to bring Israelis, Arabs, Jews, Muslims, all the interested parties in this particular conflict onto my program to talk. People who've lost family members, whether it's an Israeli or a Palestinian, you know, people who've waged peace, who've tried to wage peace, whether
right.
It's an Israeli mother or a Palestinian mother. I have them on my program. Young people who still believe in the peace process, even though it's evaporating before their eyes, they come onto the program. So there is hope. They have to be empowered, these people.
And why is the discussion so much more robust in that part of the world? You know, it's always, you can't talk about it in America, but you know where they talk about it? Israel.
Yes, they do.
They argue about it in Israel.
Yes, they do. But to be fair, they do. There's very robust arguments going on. But even they on their television are not seeing the full horror of the civilian casualties in Gaza. It's just not. They're just
right.
not. So it's very traumatized, as you know, relatives of the hostages tell me, it's still a very traumatized society. And yet, I promise you, this incredible woman, Sharon Lifshitz, she said to me, we Israelis, sometimes the Arabs look at us as if we're all the same. We're not. And we cannot look at Palestinians as if they're all Hamas. They are not. And for a woman whose parents have been held hostage, to be able to say that and how we must make friends with our enemies, otherwise right. we will keep dying.
But we cannot keep putting the onus on these individuals that governments
leadership.
And nations have to step up yeah. and step in, because it is all slipping away mm-hmm. very
yes,
rapidly.
And Ukraine is the next one you have to do, because that's a big one. We cannot take our eye off
no,
Ukraine.
No, I thought that was fixed. I think that's...
No.
I think if you check, I think
you
that's
should have
done.
Speaker Johnson, maybe?
Speaker Johnson,
Tate Green?
I can't even tell you how many times I've called yeah. that yeah. Let me tell you something. So, Speaker Johnson, they were doing, there's, you know, the Afghan Adjustment Act, where they're trying to bring in, we were trying to help them get interpreters who helped American
yeah.
troops in Afghanistan, and it was going into this omnibus bill that was going to keep the government open, and I can't tell you how many times I called that office and left messages on them going, hey, man, John Stewart of the Daily Show, really just want to make sure that Afghan Adjustment Act still, we get some visas and all that, and you know what he said when he called back? He didn't call back. The
you got me.
Hour airs Saturdays on CNN, and Amanpour & Company airs weeknights on PBS. Christiane Amanpour, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
His new book is called Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder. Please welcome to the program, Salman Rushdie. Sir!
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
First question, obviously, how are you? This was obviously a traumatic experience. How are you feeling?
I'm okay, you know. I mean, surprisingly.
Yes.
But sometimes... there are good surprises. This was one. I'm pretty much recovered.
I have to say, and I know this, it sounds peculiar to say this because of the traumatic experience that you endured. I love this book.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful work of introspection. I feel like I know now how your mind works. You know, I've read other of your books, but you really do a wonderful job of taking us through how you think.
Yeah, it's weird how I think.
No.
I mean, I have this kind of free associating mind, which goes from the moon to a movie, to a book, to a piece of mythology, to a joke.
I had to read this book with another book next to me to get just some of the references. It allows you, you know, sometimes you'll read an author's memoir and there's a certain self-consciousness to it. But maybe because this is about a traumatic incident, I feel like your defenses were down and it was very revelatory.
Yeah, I mean, there's a subject.
Right.
I mean, it's... what I felt is that it's it starts off, there's a love story which turns into a murder story which turns back into a love story.
Yes. The love story, by the way, is with his wonderful wife, Eliza, who is really the hero, maybe, of the book.
Yeah. No, I mean, she did a huge amount. And I wouldn't be here in good shape without her. And plus, she's an amazing writer.
Right.
There's that, too. I say with a certain amount of gritted teeth.
Yes. Is there competition in writerly families?
No, not really. Actually, one of the nice things about this is there isn't. We're enormously supportive of each other's work.
I thought a really interesting part of the book is, spoiler alert at the end, when you go back to Chautauqua. Chautauqua is the famed community in upstate New York where they bring in speakers and where this unfortunate event happened.
Yeah.
And you go back to revisit the scene of it, but also the jail,
yeah,
where they are holding this person, mm-hmm, that attacked you.
Yeah, it was a last-minute decision. We were actually on the plane flying up to, because I had this desire to go and revisit the scene of the crime and show myself that I was standing up where I fell down.
Right.
You know, sort of important for me. But then on the flight up there, I thought, Chautauqua was a really small town, and if he's in the county jail, how far is that from the institution? And it turned out it was like 5 minutes drive. So I thought, well, let's go to the jail.
It blows my... But you didn't have a desire necessarily to see this individual.
No, I just wanted to see the jail. You get there, it's a really boring jail. It's a little cell block and a wall with some barbed wire. But I thought, you know, he's in there, I'm out here. That feels good.
You win.
And what happened is a weird thing happened. My feet started dancing.
You were dancing?
No, my feet were dancing.
But what does that look like? It's just shimmying, you know, but the body stayed.
Well, and Eliza, my wife, said, stop doing that.
I can imagine this gentleman just glancing out the window for no apparent reason, going, is that the guy? Like,
yeah, and he's dancing in the car park.
You talk a lot about your thoughts about this gentleman and whether you wanted to confront him. There's actually a really wonderful section of it, almost like a Socratic litigation that you do in four parts.
Yeah, I make him up.
You make him up.
Yeah.
But you don't make him defenseless.
No.
The litigation that you, and the dialogue that you have with him is challenging.
Yeah. Well, I thought you know, you got to give the enemy an even break. You know, if you're going to have a serious conversation, mm-hmm, then it can't just be me yelling at him, telling him what a bad person he is, which I think.
Yes. But he wasn't. It makes you wonder about, you know, you spent since 1989, this fatwa is put upon you, and it's these fundamentalists, and these are religious extremists who have decided they're going to punish you for whatever their reasoning was. Mm. You write, though, that this gentleman is sort of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of that.
He's 24. He wasn't even born when this thing happened. And he, by his own account, had read nothing I'd written. And yet he was willing to commit murder. I mean, that's stupid.
Yes. But it's... I wonder if you think of it, does it strike you as a change in fundamentalism? You know, you say he was radicalized by Iman Youtubi.
Yeah.
That he watched YouTube videos. And do you think this attack had more to do with, like, John Lennon's attack or with a religious attack?
No, I think I think in some ways it's a very American attack.
Right.
He spent 4 years in a basement playing video games and watching videos. And it kind of messed with his head. And also, you know, I mean, he's born and bred in New Jersey.
Slow down. I think I know where this is going.
Well, then, you know, you're ahead of me. But, you know, we live in an America where people kill each other every 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, and I think maybe in his New Jersey brain.
Yes. That is how we describe it as well, by the way. He's got that New Jersey brain.
Exactly.
Do you think that there is a shift? You know, we think of fundamentalism as primarily a religious artifact. Have the algorithms made fundamentalism something different from that?
I think maybe they have. I mean, I'm too old to know, really, because I don't... Algorithms don't know what to do with me.
Right. Give them a chance.
Yeah. No, I do. But they don't know what to do. So I'm not algorithmically influenced.
Right.
But people are. People are all the time. And, yeah, I mean, I think he was... Something happened in him which made it possible for him to decide to murder a total stranger.
Right.
And that has to be brainwashing of some kind.
Right.
You know, whatever you want to call it, but I call it brainwashing.
Yeah, as I read the story, I started thinking, you know, we're so used to this idea that of violence with a cause, this idea that these, you know, there is something deep inside them that can almost be noble or understandable.
Yeah.
This is not that. It struck me more as more in common with the school shootings we see
here, exactly.
or the other things that you were just this thing he saw.
And you know what's so strange about it is, first of all, he must have known that he was messing up his own life as well.
Right.
You know, not just mine.
At 24.
At 24. And you know the last thing he did before he got on the bus from Fairview, New Jersey to Chautauqua, the last thing he did, he canceled his gym membership.
Because he knew that had weights?
He wasn't coming. Well, he knew he wasn't coming back, and why should he keep his standing order going?
Wow. So he's going through it and going like, I don't need serious radio anymore.
No,
I don't.
Exactly.
So this, was he suicidal or was he?
I don't know. I mean, maybe we'll find out. If this trial happens, we might find out more about him. But
do you dread something like that? Is that something that still visits you?
No. I mean, I think, you know, if they need me to testify, I'll go testify. And I'll be in the courtroom with him, but my view is he should be scared about being in the courtroom with me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you wonder sometimes, you know, and this is not to get, but you and I are both getting older, and you write a lot in the book about...
Speak for yourself, Chuck.
Friends, settle down. I was just on jury duty, by the way. I don't know if you saw that picture of my doppelganger. But there's mortality. You write about Martin Amis and Paul Auster and people that you've lost, even during the writing of this book, lost to esophageal cancer. You had a cancer scare.
I did.
In the middle of rehabilitation.
Yeah, in the middle of all this repair work. Suddenly, apparently, I might have prostate cancer. I thought, that's not fair.
No. Well, you're right. He writes, he goes to the doctor. Well, you can tell.
Yeah, I mean, I went to the doctor and they examining your prostate is not fun.
Again, speak for yourself. It depends on if you have a Jersey brain.
Anyway, the first examination, they thought they found a bump on the prostate, and then I had to have an MRI scan. And the MRI scan, you know, it grades from 1 to 5, and 5 is really bad. And I came out at 4,
right.
And it said cancer probable. And then it turned out that it was not probable, that it was had been caused by some other infection.
And a medicine that they had actually given you.
Yeah, exactly. And so then a second doctor... The first doctor's boss also examined my prostate more thoroughly.
Were they lined up down the hallway? What are we doing here?
No, this was very thorough. And also, he was an Indian doctor, and he was a fan of mine, so he was extra...
Nothing more uncomfortable than that.
Extra thorough.
Yes.
And he said, no, I think this might be caused by... this other infection and so on. So then I had to go back and have another MRI scan, and it said 1 to 5, it's 1, no cancer. So I had cancer for 2 months and then I didn't.
It's so incredible because you face this, as you write in the book, this 27 seconds.
Yeah.
It was just 27 seconds. And yet, do you think about, and pardon the question, but does it matter how you die? As you watched your friends and you thought about your fate and your brush with mortality, and then to have this cancer scare, did it make you think it mattered how you die?
I prefer not to.
I've got some bad news. It's coming for all of us.
Bad news for all of us.
Yes.
But I mean, I don't know. My wife Eliza and I have decided we're planning our 100th birthday party, my 100th birthday. And I think it has to be a dance party.
Yes.
So we're trying
just
to,
your feet, though, not the whole body.
So we tried to decide who should DJ. Any tips?
I'll pick somebody.
Yeah, right.
But it strikes me because you, whether you've wanted this mantle or not, and I'm assuming you don't, you represent something. You represent a courage and a freedom of artistic expression, of the importance of artistic expression, and of the danger that artistic expression often visits upon the people who do it. It's a noble shield to carry, but not an easy one, I don't imagine.
Not an easy one. And in a way, there's bits of me that would prefer to be well known for being, you know, a good writer.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm pretty sure that's in there, too.
Is that in there? Yeah. I see. But, you know, it used to be when I started out as a writer, when people would write about my books, they would mention that they were funny. And then after the attack on the Satanic Verses, everybody stopped saying I was funny.
Really?
And it's
because that book is satirical.
And people who read it, I get two reactions to people who read it now. One is, where's the dirty bit? Because we can't find it.
Yeah.
And the second is, who knew it was funny? And I say, people who read it. Funny.
But it's, you know, with that on you, do you feel there's an idea that you have to wear that heroism?
I don't know about the heroism, but I think I have to be part of the fight.
Right.
You know, I mean, there is a fight about free expression in America too at the moment, and I feel like I'm in that fight. I have a dog in that fight.
What do you think how the nature of fundamentalism has changed, and how that affects artistic expression? Like, even now when we see all the protests, you know, up at Columbia University, some students protest this, others think that's going too far and they're threatening people. And we're crossing all those difficult lines. You spoke at the Penn banquet, yes?
Yeah, last year.
Last year, which is a consortium of writers and poets and a lot of people, truly defenders of free speech.
Yeah.
I just got a text today. They've canceled.
They've canceled the prize giving because they have people attacking them for not being sufficiently anti-Israeli or pro-Palestinian or something.
Right.
I mean, everybody's so angry right now.
Right.
That nobody can listen or talk to anybody else. So people just shout at each other.
Listen, there was a critic, and this is going to sound like a joke, a critic of Taylor Swift's new music album, The Torture Poe Society. They had to remove the critic's name from the critique because of death threats.
Because he didn't like the record?
I didn't read it. Because I love the record.
Yeah. Of course.
And I don't want to hear any negativity.
No. But so do I, John.
But it speaks to, in 1989, there was an ayatollah and a fatwa and a group of religious muckety-mucks who delivered the law from high above. And now we're all fundamentalists.
Everybody's an expert. Everybody's got an opinion.
And hostility.
And hostility. The level of anger is crazy right now.
Do you think of, you know, you have a dog in the fight in that creative. How do we, and I think about this a lot, how do we manage that, and is that just a function of the algorithm?
It might be. I think to an extent it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Frankly, I'm glad you asked me because I'm the answer. Have the answer to the world's problems.
It's actually on page. If
it's
I would.
Right there. Exactly.
But no, you are thoughtful enough, and you've been through it enough that I know you have an opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I just think people have to stop having such thin skins.
Mm-hmm.
You know. At the moment, we're all very easily offended. And what's more is we also believe that being offended is a sufficient reason for attacking something.
Right.
But actually, everything offends somebody.
You know, always.
Always. I mean, occasionally you.
What? How dare you, sir? I am offended.
Yeah. You see, and then if you go down that road, then we can't talk to each other anymore.
Right.
You know?
But haven't groups always had a way of policing language or behavior. I think I'm trying to think, has my perspective changed on it, or has the dynamic changed?
I think what's happened is the temperature has risen.
Right. You know,
I mean, yes, of course, people have always disagreed, and people have always said, you can't say that, you've got to say this. That's not new. What's new is the volume and the heat.
Right.
You know, and so what do we do about taking down the volume and taking down the heat? That's the question.
I mean, and again, not to make you the avatar of this, but this is coming from a man who, because of threats from fundamentalists, had to basically alter your entire life.
Well, it did certainly have an impact, yeah. Yeah. I mean, what is sad is that I'd actually got my life back, really. I mean, I've been living in New York City for getting on for 25 years.
Right. And well, you had made a decision, I'm going to come out of this, yeah, and make myself
available. Yeah, and
available.
For 23 years, it was fine.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I was doing everything that writers do. Book tours, readings, lectures, you know.
Oh, I know, I'm a writer. Don't stop. I've been there with the coffee klatches.
Yeah.
So and you, Oprah.
Yeah. Well, I haven't been with Oprah.
None of us have.
None of us. But anyway, so it was a shock when this thing out of a quarter of a century ago, more than that, 30 years ago, sort of came out of a crowd at me. You know, it was, I really was very surprised.
Do you find yourself now freed of that fear, or is, yes, there still that PTSD? Like, what does that do to you?
Well, I mean, it does, you know, nothing good.
Right.
But it's now been, what, 20 months or something. I think I'm pretty much back to myself at this point.
Do you feel like you're in that writing rhythm again? Has your mind started to dream
this,
again?
Let's finish this, John.
And by the way, let me tell you something. We don't have people on where I don't either, you know, read it or take a look. It's such a beautiful and incredibly interesting and revelatory book. I really thank you for writing it, because you had to endure something awful, but your insight into that experience is really a remarkable gift give to other people.
Thank you.
And I really do appreciate it.
And it's got funny bits.
A couple of funny bits. Not, yeah. For a writer. Not for a comic. Writer. For a writer. Yeah. But it really is a fantastic piece of work, and I thank you for doing it. The book is called Knife. It is available as we speak. Salman Rushdie.
Explore more shows from the Daily Show podcast universe by searching The Daily Show wherever you get your podcasts. Watch The Daily Show weeknights at 11, 10 Central on Comedy Central, and stream full episodes anytime on Paramount Plus.
This has been a Comedy Central podcast.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.